You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Episode 150, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Clarkson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's expert is really amazing. It's David Cotterno. He's the CEO and head of ePowered Benefits. And we are going to really explain why the healthcare system is so messed up. I've done a lot of episodes on this in the past, usually where we focus on one or two aspects of the payment system, insurance, the interplay between insurance and pharmaceuticals and hospitals. Dave Cotterno really summarized things so well. You will have a profound understanding of why there's so much dysfunction. If you're a physician, you're going to understand why when you talk to insurance companies, they don't seem to really care about things you think they would care about. If you're a patient, why are you having these crazy bills? Why are insurance plans not getting better? Why are they worse? Why are they more expensive? Why, again, do the hospitals not seem to care about you? Why do insurance companies not seem to care about you? And I suppose on some level, you kind of intuitively know why those two entities don't really care that much for you because you're not really directly paying their bills. But ultimately, it's a very strange relationship we have with medicine as physicians, as patients, and you know the institutions that sort of run things. But David is going to really go into it deeply because he was a broker for insurance companies. He sold these packages. He interacted with the insurance companies. He's the one who would go to the hospitals and find what they're doing and find ways to make better deals. And with his new business, where he is essentially, much like Katie Tepton I had on earlier, many episodes ago, will help you set up your self-funded plan, but not just a self-funded plan, in which case you use the usual sort of healthcare players in your community. And that is very important because if you just use the same people who are doing things with the same products and plans they have in place, well, you're not going to save any money, right? I mean, you may change the risk a little bit. You might shave a couple percent off, but you're not going to make any significant savings. It's only through actually finding less expensive healthcare and usually higher quality healthcare are you going to actually move the needle is for your employees or for your business. So if you are someone who has a small, medium-sized business, this is absolutely something you should listen to. If you're confused about why the third-party payer system doesn't work, this will be a great summation. David does a great job of going through a bunch of different aspects of it. And I can't recommend enough how much you're going to get from this episode. But I don't thank my patrons enough who are on patreon.com. So big shout out to Belen, Erte, Anthony, Tom, Brian, Pam, Jill, Brandon, Lucas. You guys are greatly appreciated. I can't tell you how much it means to me to have people who support the show financially make the show free for everyone else who's listening. If you think, boy, this is a great show, I would love to support it, I'd recommend you go to patreon.com/theparadox and spell the same way as the show, with P-R-A-D-O-C-S. There you can become a supporter of the show for as little as $2 a month. And again, it not only provides financial support to help pay for just the services, we're now moving to video of the show, but also really, it's just so encouraging to have people who feel strongly enough about the show and what we're doing and talking about, and really get a message out that I don't think a lot of places are. We've focused on Nodalea medicine, some COVID certainly, but really the payment system and finding people who are doing disruptive, innovative things in this healthcare space. And I hope you've learned a lot. I know I've used a lot of things that I've talked to as far as people to not only change my practice, but sort of how we go about our business. And I hope you've gotten some of the things out of that too, as well as just a general understanding and hopefully kind of fun conversations. So today's absolutely fun conversation, super informative. And I hope you continue to share the show with your friends and family. This is a great one to share with them and colleagues because it's going to really encapsulate why the healthcare system is so messed up. Maybe not always solutions for every person in every situation, But I think you're going to get an idea of what you should look for if you're in a business or if you're an individual looking for coverage. But without further ado, David Cotterno from ePower Benefits in making sure you get a healthcare broker who works for you. Enjoy. Well, hi, I'm here with my new friend, David Cotterno. He's the CEO and founder of ePower Benefits. And we're going to talk about healthcare, as we always do in the show. But specific, we're going to talk about ways of disrupting medicine, which again, is pretty much all we talk about in this healthcare show. So David, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Well, I was really happy, pleased when you reached out to me because, you know, there are all these sorts of moving parts in healthcare. There are the people who are obviously delivering the care, the physicians, the hospitals, surgery centers, et cetera. They're the people who are receiving the care or, you know, the patients, sometimes the physicians who are right next to the patients. But there are always people who are in between. They're, you know, the dreaded middlemen, the people who are coordinating things. And that's sort of where you find yourself, right? And so why don't you describe exactly what you do or what you did and what you're doing now?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of middlemen in healthcare and health insurance, probably too many, but I would like to start sort of level set with all the listeners and say, we need to separate health insurance from healthcare. We often intermingle those two words. And if you ask most of America who their healthcare provider is, they're going to say Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And yet Blue Cross and Blue Shield provides no healthcare whatsoever. So I've been what most people would know as a broker to employers, and employers fund about 50% of healthcare in the United States. I was going into employers, bringing the likes of Blue Cross, United, Cigna, and Aetna. And it was a pretty sweet gig, Eric, because I never had to worry about getting paid because I got paid by the carriers, and most employers will sooner not pay their power bill than they would not pay their health insurance bill. So I got a percentage of that premium every time they sent in a bill. And guess what? Their rates went up 10, 15, 20% a year. So guess what else went up 10, 15, 20% a year? But that's not the only way I was paid. That's called disclosed compensation, but there's lots of undisclosed compensation. I get calls all the time, especially around this time of the year. They would say, David, this is United Healthcare. Do you know if you write just one more group with us before the end of the year, you're going to get a $250,000 bonus? Or sometimes the other way, Blue Cross would call and say, David, if you lose one more group of yours this year to a competitor of ours, you're going to lose your $250,000 bonus. And it wasn't just checks. It was trips to Ireland, private cruises. I mean, they lavish on us. And I get into arguments with people sometimes, but they don't do it if it didn't work. Drug companies wouldn't advertise on TV if it didn't impact the amount of drugs being prescribed. And likewise, I mean, RVUs wouldn't be used if it didn't influence the way doctors prescribe treatment.
Sure.
But it does, and it is. And so what I say to a lot of people, I say a lot of people call our healthcare system broken. It's not broken. It's working exactly as it was designed to work. It just wasn't designed by employers, doctors, or patients. So it's not working well for those three entities, but it's working really well for a lot of people.
I feel like in many ways you can look at the healthcare system and say it's designed to spend the most amount of money possible.
That's right.
That you probably couldn't design a better system for wasting money and, you know, sending money to places that aren't actually delivering any care or providing any value.
Yep.
Our health system, whether it's, you know, pharmacy benefit managers, whether it's, you know, brokers or whoever.
Yep.
So you're really exposing and things I hadn't really thought about, the broker aspect of things, because you know, I was president of my anesthesia group for about 4 years. We have a broker, and mm-hmm. I think most large employers have brokers, people who go on the market, find plans. This is in theory, they negotiate with the insurance companies, they find the best plan. They find you savings. They, you know, compare Aetna to Blue Cross to, in our case, be Priority, and there's, you know, some other United Healthcare, whatever.
Yep.
And then they come back to you with the plans. That you're, here are the five options mm-hmm. for your employees, an HMO, you know, point of service care, some sort of combination agent, HSA or something.
Yeah.
And you pay them some money, but it's usually not a whole lot from the employer, because presumably they're getting their money from commissions, like you said. Now, can you break down where most of the revenue comes from these people? Because, you know, a truth in life, I suppose, when it comes to commerce, is whoever pays the bills is who that is, the real customer is, right? It's like, it's sort of like with Google, right? It's totally free, which means that you're the customer,
you're
right?
Yep. Yeah. So first of all, I agree with you. And I say it, that a person works for whoever signs their paycheck, and most brokers' paychecks are signed by Blue Cross or United or Cigna or Aetna. And it really is, they are a seller's agent. They can purport themselves to be a buyer's agent, which they frequently do. But I mean, they're working for the seller of those products and services. And so typically the most common is a commission where it's, I don't know, 3 to 5% of this ever ballooning premium. You don't need to write a lot of business to be making a decent income as a commission-based broker. Now, some insurance companies have gone to flat fee or per employee per month, which I acknowledge does remove the perverse incentive, but it doesn't align the incentive. It doesn't do anything to do that. And there's an Upton Sinclair quote that I've been saying a lot lately. It says, do not, and I wish it were more gender neutral, but I'll say it as it was, do not expect a man to understand something in which his paycheck is dependent upon him not understanding it. Yes. And let me tell you how important that is. What I changed first before I took this different path was how I get paid. And I moved to a performance-based model. So with our clients, we're contractually prohibited from receiving any money from anywhere except the client. And typically we have a bonus at the end of the year from the client for doing what the client wants us to do, which is actually lower healthcare costs. Now, at the time that I made this deal with that first client, I realized I didn't know anything, nothing about healthcare costs, despite the fact that I had quote unquote been in the business for at that point, 18 years. And you described a process that's really broken, and every employer goes through it, but let me give you an analogy. Let's pretend that you and your wife went to buy a car and your budget was $300 a month for that car, but the salesperson was so good that you walk out with $1,000 a month car payment. So a few months later, you and your wife sit at the coffee table and you say, we need to come up with a strategy to lower this monthly car payment. Do you think if you called up Geico, even if you save 15% 15 minutes later, is that going to lower your car payment to the bank at all? Not even a little bit, right? What if you raise your deductible on your car insurance from $500 to $1,000? Is that going to lower your monthly car payment? Not a little bit. What if you decide to self-insure your car insurance? You're going to just put money in the bank and pay for the accident if and when they occur. Is that going to lower your car payment? No. Right, this notion that we can switch from Blue Cross to United to Cigna to Aetna or from HMO to PPO to HSA, they don't work. As a matter of fact, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study of the average single and family premiums of HMOs, POSs, PPOs, indemnities, and HSAs, and they were all within a few percentage points of each other. My stroke of genius for the day, there's only one way to pay less for healthcare. You have to pay less for healthcare.
Right.
That's
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when I tied my revenue to that, they say that necessity is the mother of all invention. I had to figure out a way to pay less for healthcare. And when I really dug into how healthcare is delivered and paid for, I was already expecting dysfunction, but I am still a decade later, sometimes smacked in the face at how dysfunctional delivery of care and payment of care is in this country. And that's what we change within our health plans. If your broker or consultant is not talking about how to change how care is paid for, how much is it determined to cost, and how you're going to source it at the highest quality and the lowest cost and determine those things, then they're not going to change anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I talked to Keith Smith recently, and then even before, way back at the beginning of the show, episode 12, I mean, we discussed about the dysfunction of the insurance, the model, I guess you'd say, that there is not an incentive for the insurance companies really to lower costs in some ways, which seems counterintuitive, right? You think that they want to lower their costs so they can remain competitive in the market, so they can, you know, sell the product for less than their competitors, but that does not seem to be the case, right? There's actually a perverse incentive for them to have higher prices, because they get, you know, just as you mentioned earlier, your fee is based in many ways on a percentage of how much is spent, right? And so the more that's spent, the more or the savings, perceived savings they provide, they get a percentage of it. They save money. Explain the process, because again, for most people, this is the hardest thing to understand, because you immediately think hospitals, insurance companies, they're absolutely at loggerheads, right? They're one's fighting to keep the raise prices, the other's fighting to lower them, which would make sense, right? In normal competition, right? You have your supply and demand, that they're fighting each other to keep things, to find some equilibrium.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not the fight that goes on. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. The first is, you know, pick any metropolitan area, you know, pick Minneapolis, for example. If any employer in Minneapolis left United Healthcare, would United Healthcare's balance sheet even be impacted by a little? No, they're $260 billion company. But what if Mayo Clinic left their network? Then every employer in every area that Mayo Clinic has a location is going to leave. So problem number one is that makes the hospitals more the customer of the insurance company than the employer, the patient, or anyone else. Now, it gets worse than that. Let's say, let's pretend that I run United Healthcare for the state of Minnesota. And right around now, actually a few months ago, I had to file my rates for my fully insured plans for 2022 because those need to be filed and approved by the Department of Insurance. So I'm going to go to my team of really well-paid actuaries and I'm going to ask them, how much do you think everyone in the state of Minnesota is expected to spend on my plan in 2022 for medical and prescription costs? Because those are the biggest expenses of any plan, right? So let's pretend they come back with a number of $850 million. I'm just making this up, but they come back with $850 million. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to set my premiums around the state to ensure that I bring in $1 billion. That's going to leave me $150 million to cover my overhead. And then I better damn sure send some profit back to the mothership as a privately traded company, a publicly traded company, sorry. So 2022 comes along and every month it's preordained. I'm collecting 1/12 of $1 billion. But you know all the cost containment tools that every carrier throws at every employer and every member every year? Let's pretend in 2022 they actually work. And instead of $850 million, everyone in Minnesota only spends $425 million in claims. I ask every employer and even people in our industry, I still collected $1 billion. Did my profit go up or go down? And everybody, with very rare exceptions, says, of course, your profit went up. You collected $1 billion. You spent only $425 million.
Right.
That's not true. The medical loss ratio provision of the Affordable Care Act says that I must spend 85 cents of every dollar. Otherwise, I have to return the money to the members of the plan. So I would have to return not just the $425 million of claims I didn't spend, but $75 million of the $150 million of overhead and profit. So literally, if a carrier were to shrink costs, claims, lower claims, they would then violate the only fiduciary responsibility they have, which is to their shareholders to deliver profit. Now, some employer might be listening to this and say, oh, phew, I'm self-funded, so that doesn't apply to me. You're right. The medical loss ratio provision doesn't apply to you, but in your wisdom, you put yourself on all the same administration platforms, the same PPO contracts, the same pharmacy contracts, and the same medical management vendor in which those things do apply. Do you think that somehow you're going to be immune from that inflation? So what I tell people is we have Stockholm syndrome in this country with the health insurance carriers and everybody. Think about it from this perspective. As a broker, I ask the insurance company, what products and services can I sell my clients and how much are you going to pay me to do it? Employers say, what benefits can I offer my employees and how much is it going to cost me? Doctors say, what prescriptions and treatments can I provide and how much are you going to pay me? Hospitals say, how long can we keep them in the bed for and how long is it going to take you to pay us? Like, we all look to the insurance company to ask permission, and they're controlling the gates in such a way that they benefit as costs go up and quality of care goes down. That's why cost of care keeps going up and quality of care keeps going down. But it is fixable. It is changeable. And many of the tools already exist.
Well, before you go into that, when you look at the insurance companies, one solution is people say they self-fund it, right? And as you mentioned, so, large employers, they say, we're going to not buy the package plan from Blue Cross or whatever, and we're going to self-fund this. How is that not a solution to the problem?
Because a fully insured plan has several components. It has a plan administrator. If you're with Blue Cross, that is, of course, Blue Cross. Mm-hmm. It has a PPO network. And if you're with Blue Cross, that is, of course, Blue Cross. It has a PBM. And if you're with Blue Cross, it's almost certainly either owned by Blue Cross or it's one that they share revenue on. They have a medical management vendor owned by Blue Cross. So why, when all the players are the same, why do you expect there to be anything different? But let's go a step further. The town I live in North Carolina, there's a Lowe's Home Improvement is headquartered here. So there's this massive campus. And I happen to know that Lowe's has a self-funded Aetna plan managed by Aetna. So let's pretend that a Lowe's employee goes to the hospital. And Joe the plumber, he has 10 employees. He's a fully insured Aetna plan. He also has an employee that goes to the same hospital, same provider, same procedure. And they're both coded and billed exactly the same. What's the price of that procedure relative to each other? exactly the same, right? Because they both flow through the same Aetna PPO contract. So this notion that larger employers get better pricing is BS. Maybe they get a little better pricing on the fringe. So maybe that 15%, that's their fixed cost. Maybe they save 10% on that. But let's remember 10% of 15% is 1.5%. Hardly anything to write home about. But the huge majority of care is costing the same. And carriers, I know United, we took over a client that had, they were self-funded with United Healthcare. And do you know, even though they were self-funded, they were paying United Healthcare a $25,000 a year fee to allow them to bring their own PBM in instead of using Optum, which is owned by United Healthcare. Why do you think that is? Because they make money. The ugliness on drug pricing, it's really the drugs that I think there are such easy things we could do to make some things illegal that are already illegal in other areas of our economy that are just really dirty and really ugly and really hurt the patient more than anything. But the point is would you think you're going to be more transparent? But here's what I would encourage any self-funded employer to do. The contract between your insurance carrier and the provider is the contract that really determines your price. And as you know, the carrier has tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of those contracts. I implore any employer listening to this to go to their insurance company and say, can I look at one of those contracts that's actually determining my price? Just one. They're going to say no. You basically, as a self-funded employer, sign one contract that obligates you to the provisions of hundreds of thousands of other contracts that you can never see. And let's remember, you touched on it earlier, when a hospital and an insurance company go to negotiate their contract, they go into this backdoor sealed off room couched in tons of non-disclosure agreements, and they both benefit from costs going up. And we wonder why costs keep going up. The reason they fight it out is because the insurance company doesn't want their costs going up any faster than their competition, or to your point earlier, they price themselves out of the market. But even medical management, when they deny care, what they typically do is they deny the high value, low cost care. They deny the physical therapy, so you're more likely to have the back surgery. They deny the care that is most likely to get you well quickest, so that you can go to a place where you're going to get well the most expensively, if you get well at all, because that's what benefits the insurance company. They don't make money by denying claims. They make money by paying claims. And the more claims they pay, the more money they make.
And I'm always surprised with nowadays, there are lots of insurance companies that are actually affiliated with healthcare systems. And so it's stunning to me that that even is something that exists. I mean, that's the most vertical integration that you could possibly have, right? You have the people. Mm-hmm. And there are... you talk to people who work within those sort of systems. I mean, I work within one. I mean, I know other people who do too. And there's still like this, there's this tension between the insurance company didn't approve it in this hospital. You're like, well, that doesn't, you'd think that they would work. There'd be some efficiency. Like if you're going to do this, that you would be able to provide better care or better continuity or something like that, that it would actually benefit the insurance company would be able to get their processes that they say would maybe, you know, provide higher quality and lower cost. It'd be easier to implement it within the healthcare system if that healthcare system, you know, is owned by them or vice versa. Yeah, that doesn't seem to be the case either.
No, none of them want quality to go up and care to go down. That's less revenue. I mean, the whole system is built on quantity. And, you know, they, even when it was just healthcare systems combining together, they would say, well, we're going to consolidate billing and we're going to buy supplies in bigger bulk. You know, I want to give a call out to Dr. Keith Smith, who I know was on your podcast recently. And I've been to his facility. I had surgery at his facility. And since 1993, when he opened up his doors, he's had four price adjustments. And all four of those price adjustments have been down. But if he's buying the same anesthesia, the same IV pumps, the same beds, the same implants, why are his costs going down and everyone else is going up? I'm going to tell you why. In the last 20 years, we've had a 5% decrease of clinical staff in this country, and that's pre-COVID. It might even be worse now. But at the same time period, there was a 2,800% increase in administration staff. When I walked through Keith Smith's facility, he had one part-time person in his billing office. That was it. So we built health plans that support and embrace places like Keith Smith because we never make him have to file a claim. All he does is pay an invoice or send an invoice. And then with our plans, that we build for employers, when patients go to places like Keith Smith or thousands of them that we have relationships around the country, we completely waive out of pockets. And that's another pressure point that's in the system. Hospitals on average write off about 75% of patient responsibility. And as deductibles and co-pays have gone up, think about this waterfall for a second. I'm an average American. I have a high deductible health plan. I need insulin, but I can't afford it. So I'm taking it every other day, not as often as I should, right, which of course increases the likelihood of something major happens. So now something major happens. Now I'm rushed to the hospital. Now I have to pay the $5,000 I didn't have to begin with. And that's why the number one cause of bankruptcy in the US is medical bills, with about 2/3 of those people having had health insurance. So now I go into bankruptcy, but I get the care that I need. Okay. Well, that large claim that results in a large write-off, because the hospital gets part of the claim. They write off the $5,000 from me because I didn't have it. So when that hospital goes to negotiate with the insurance company, they say, hey, we're writing off all this bad debt because you're slinging all these high deductible health plans. We need an increase in our reimbursement rate as a result. And as we described before, the hospital is very happy to do that. It benefits them. It benefits the hospital. So they give an increase in reimbursement rate, or reduce the discount, or allow the starting price to be higher, whatever you want to call it. And that results in higher premiums for the next year for the employers in the market. And right, the only thing that the average broker can do when those premiums go up is make the deductibles higher to offset some of that increase, which causes more write-offs, higher reimbursement rates, worse plans. And that's why we have this increased cost and deterioration of benefits going on. And employers that we talk to now, not our clients, but the ones that come to us, they're typically coming to us because now they're in among the worst plan that the ACA allows you to have. So you can't raise your out-of-pockets any more than what the ACA allows. And they still get a 10, 20, we've seen 40 and 60 and 80% rate increases this year, more frequently than we're used to. So this, I call that the circling the drain that most employers are slowly doing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, from an insurance standpoint, actuarially, right, they can figure out your costs, they can move them around, but they end up making the same amount of money, and you pay the same essentially, but it's just in a different manner, right? Like, you look at the different plans and options you have within your company that you get from the broker, and they all end up being about, you end up spending about the same amount of money, but just in different ways. You know, like, are you gambling? Do you feel like you're not going to actually have any healthcare expenses, and you go with the high deductible because your chance may be a little less? But from the insurance company standpoint, just like, you know, life insurance, they know the likelihood of someone's going to die. They know what percentage, and they know how to calculate the cost, right? So they end up, I guess, in the same spot in the end.
Yeah, the difference, though, is health, all types of insurance are meant to pay for low frequency, high intensity, low predictability claims. But health insurance is high frequency, highly predictable, low cost claims. We expect that. And then we still want it to pay for the high cost stuff too. Insurance just doesn't work that way. It's simply not sustainable for any insurance to work like that. If our car insurance paid for every, you know, tire and brake, and your car insurance would be a lot different too.
Yeah, I've never had a claim for a new battery. I just go to the store and buy one. So then let's talk about the alternatives, right? So we talk about how broken the system is, which I don't know that you find anybody outside of people who are profiting from the system to say, yeah, it's great. So how do you fix this? I've talked to Katie Talento, and she directly contracts with everybody. I mean, is that similar to what you do, or how do you set something up for small, medium, large-size employers?
So, I mean, we have to build them a health plan that's partially self-funded. Now, I want to just talk about that. Employers all the time say self-funded's riskier. No, it's not. It can be riskier if either your broker doesn't know how to build a self-funded plan, or you choose for it to be riskier. Because what most employers don't understand is, in a fully insured plan, there's reinsurance levers in there. It's called pooling points. It's determined by the insurance carrier. And they're typically doing much higher pooling points than you would do on your own, because they're aggregating your business over hundreds or thousands of other employers. But in a partially self-funded plan, we'd pick an independent third-party administrator like the Kempton Group, with Jay Kempton, who started FMMA with Keith Smith. And they have to be paid in the right way. So there are some TPAs that make money very similarly to the insurance carriers. They make money on claims. They make money on percent of savings. They make money on spread pricing from the pharmacy benefit manager. And we don't allow that. Our TPAs are going to charge a per employee per month, and that's their only revenue. But right off the bat, you know, that puts us, if we're competing against another broker, for example, who does self-insured, a lot of the carriers will sell a level funded plan or a self-funded plan, sorry, with a $5 per employee per month admin fee if you just let us handle everything. Yeah, come on. You know they're making it so much multiple times over on the back end. But we don't mind a $30 or $40 PEPM. They should be paid. They're the quarterback of the team. They're the ones who protect the pocketbook the most day to day. You should want to pay them properly because they play a very important role. Then we put in a similar transparent pharmacy benefit manager. And there's so much that goes on in pharmacy benefit management, but the couple of things we don't allow in particular is spread pricing and any of the rebate holdbacks. And we prefer a pharmacy benefit manager that gets paid a per employee per month or a per member per month, because we source medications outside of the PBM and retail channels as much as possible. And I'll give you one strategy we use that eliminates 6- and 7-figure drugs from the cost completely. Have you ever heard at the end of a commercial on TV, the drug commercial, it says, if you cannot afford your medication, AstraZeneca, maybe it'll help. And they say really fast and really low. Well, what they're describing there is something called a PAP, or a prescription assistance program. Now that's for someone that doesn't have coverage for the drug. Let me explain what I mean. If you have a $5,000 deductible and you have $500 in your checking account or savings account, you have coverage for the drug, even though you can't afford it. This is for someone who has no insurance at all, or whose plan specifically excludes this drug. Now, most PBMs are not going to let you exclude a drug at your will because they make money every time they fill a drug.
Right.
But that's talking about something that every manufacturer who deals with Medicare must offer. And basically, it works on a multiple of the federal poverty level. And it also is tied to the cost of the drug. So as the drug prices have gone up, so too has the multiple of the federal poverty level. People can be making well into the 6 figures and still qualify. So what we do is we see the drug pop up in the fill. We usually, you know, stop it from the first time, although if they need it, we'll let it go through one time to give them a supply. And then we'll check their income and household size. And if they qualify for the PAP, we have a person that walks them through the process. And we're 99% successful because we do the work in advance. And once we're approved for that PAP, then the drug company sends that drug to that member at no cost to the plan, no cost to the member. And that's how we get rid of some of those really expensive drugs.
Would you say that's one of the larger, I mean, when you look at potential savings, when you start up a program like this, pharmaceuticals has got to be one of the largest ones, right? You always imagine hospital and ICU stays and those sorts of things, but it's probably pharmaceuticals, which is the most common point that you're going to save money, right?
If you break inpatient and outpatient out, then pharmacy is bigger. But if you combine inpatient and outpatient together, then hospitalization is bigger. But they're each about, they're, you know, 20 to 25% each, inpatient and outpatient and prescriptions, with the rest going to providers. Only 4% roughly goes to emergency care, urgent care, DME. A lot of people are like, emergency care is a big cost. It's really not. Comparatively to everything else that's going on.
Sure.
Focus on the predictable, planable things, not the ones you can't predict.
Right. I mean, I guess it's fair to say emergency care is expensive, but it's the occurrence rate is a lot lower than the amount of people who go to the hospital for a gallbladder or whatever it might be.
Right.
One of the interesting things that I learned with this whole process of sort of separating the different components of healthcare insurance, like a package, is it called stop loss? Is that where essentially the insurance company insures for catastrophic care for you as well? It's just part of your package. And
that's
so if
right.
you're self-funded and you actually have to purchase that insurance as well. And so you say, well, we'll cover the first 100,000 or whatever it might be, right? And then everything beyond that is a different insurance company that actually provides coverage for that care. I never realized that was part of a typical insurance package. And that you can actually just provide for that yourself and then keep some funds back, and so that maybe the next year you don't need it.
Yeah, but the key is you have to change how care is paid for, or your plan is going to be no better running than when you were fully insured. So, for example, I mentioned the type of PBMs we use. We also don't use the services of a PPO network, because the second you stick a PPO network in place, you've lost all control of costs. The contract is driving, and again, they won't let you see the contract. So most of our plans have no PPO network at all. We have a couple that have a doctor-only network, and we use other pricing methodologies around the plan. And our most preferred pricing methodology by far is a place like Surgery Center of Oklahoma, where they just say, hey, here's our price and here's our quality. Nice. But quality is a big piece too of our plans. When we steer people somewhere to where we eliminate the out-of-pocket, which we do all the time. And that's why I don't believe in HSAs. As a matter of fact, I know I'm going to upset some people, but I call HSA compatible plans the single most damaging strategy that my industry has ever unleashed on the unsuspecting American public, because it is damaging. And when it first came out and it was so much cheaper that employers were funding the full deductible, it didn't change anything, but okay. But what's eroded? The deductibles have gone up and the contribution from the employer has gone down. And now most employers are woefully underfunded in their HSA account. And all they have is a crap. I mean, let me tell you what an HSA compatible plan is. It's the crappiest of crappiest plans that the ACA allows you to buy, period. It just, right. That's just it.
And then with HSAs, you know, obviously the thought was, is that as the patients control and direct their healthcare money, their dollars, mm-hmm. they're going to look for low-cost alternatives that are high quality, whatever.
Yeah.
What is that? Just does that just not happen because you're within the confines of a lousy system and there's just no exit to get to a spot that you can save money?
There's a few reasons. The system said, here, we're going to give you more skin in the game and we want you to be a good consumer. But what do you need to be a good consumer? You need cost and quality. It's impossible to be a good consumer of anything if you don't have cost and quality. And those are the things that the system has been fighting to hide. Even when laws go into effect, they still fight to hide them and make it very difficult. So we have access to cost and quality around the country at almost every provider and facility. And that's why we say to employees, look, you can go wherever you want to go. Like I said, we don't have a network. So you can continue to go where you're going. And we're still going to save the employer a ton of money for two reasons. One is how we price the care. And the other is those PPO contracts typically have audit prohibition clauses in them. We don't have those contracts. And so, and just to give you a couple of stories, there's a hospital down in Texas that was doing a pregnancy test on every admission, even if that patient were male, post-hysterectomy, post-menopause, it didn't matter because they were taking a 14-cent test and marking it up $1,400, and they knew the carriers couldn't look deep enough to find it. We had another hospital that was doing surgical implants in the spine. They were using surgical screws, and they billed for 12 screws, which caught a red flag for me because I know the national average for that type of screw is 7. So I asked for full clinical notes and I got the notes and it said they had only implanted 8. And when I called them and I said, why did you charge for 12 when you implanted 8? They said, well, it came in a pack of 12. We had to throw the other 4 away because they weren't sterile. And I said, they didn't come in a pack of 12. You ordered them in a pack of 12. The manufacturer lets you order them in any quantity you want, but you order them for way more than the national average. So you knew you could charge way more than the national average. Insurance companies are not only not motivated to find these things because, again, more claims going out the door is more money, but they're prohibited from asking for the information that would allow them. But let's say by some freak of nature, they find one of these things a year or two later. Listen to this craziness. If they're fully insured, if it was on a fully insured plan, the carrier gets to keep the full amount. If it's a self-funded plan, I encourage any self-funded employer to go read their administrative services agreement. It's going to say that if the TPA finds an overpayment, they're going to be able to keep 40% or 20% or 50% of what they find. So what's their incentive to even look when the less they look, the more money they make, and the more that goes out the door erroneously, the more potential money they make down the road?
So when it comes to trying to set up a program like this, I mean, obviously they're regular brokers, we'll call them people who sell, and they oftentimes will say, hey, I can also help you set up a self-funded plan if that's what you want to do. Yeah. Why are they the wrong people to do this? Because, I mean, obviously you want people who specialize in a certain process so they have they align the incentives, but why is that a particularly bad idea? I mean, that's my guess is that's what you feel like. And I say this that we, you know, if our group is looking actually at, you know, trying to self-direct our health insurance and we have a broker that we've used for years, why would we be worried that this broker might not be the person who can sort of pivot and start helping us with the self-funding part of a plan?
If all they're bringing to you is the local carrier or two and the national carriers, they're not bringing any value at all. And I will tell you, in healthcare and in health insurance, the bigger, the worse. The bigger the insurance company, the worse these metrics occur. The bigger the broker, the bigger the bonuses they're getting on the back end. I mean, you look at a USI and Aon, a Gallagher, they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses. Insane amounts. And again, most of them are non-disclosed bonuses. So the bigger the health system, the more they do these things. And the bigger the broker, the more they do these things. But at the end of the day, if your broker, if they're talking about the stuff that brokers have been talking about for years, wellness programs and consumer-driven health plans, like, when are you going to, how many times would you bring your car to the same mechanic to get your air conditioning working when it wasn't working every time? How many times would you go? Because I feel like employers, they keep sticking their finger in the light socket and they expect that it's not going to electrocute them at some point, but the power just keeps getting turned up and up and up every year. It's not going down. So if your broker or consultant doesn't demonstrate to you that they understand how healthcare is paid for and delivered, if they don't understand how doctors are paid, you know, I mentioned an RVU to you. Most people have no idea what an RVU is. Right. We talk about patient volumes, how primary care doctors have to see 30 or 40 patients every single day to feed the system. And so an RVU, for those that don't know, is a measurement of how much revenue that doctor is generating for their healthcare system. And so if I'm a primary care doctor and you come into me with a bad back, my most profitable path by far is to cut you a script for an opioid that's going to deal with the pain. It's going to get you out of my office as quickly as possible so I can move on to the next patient because I got to see 30 or 40 in a day. And then I'm going to refer you to my buddy, the back surgeon, where the most likely outcome is the most expensive outcome. That's how I maximize my profit. Now, do I think doctors intentionally send you to a back surgeon for back surgery when back surgery isn't necessary? No. Do I think most brokers intentionally allow your insurance to inflate every year, even though it benefits them? No. But again, back to that Upton Sinclair quote, if that's what you know, that's how you're paid, you don't look anywhere else. So it's not like you're intentionally sending them there knowing it's the worst option. You just don't know that a better option exists because you haven't looked. And so that's the way I think of brokers. That's the way I think of doctors. And this notion, one other thing that I want to talk about doctors, I hear hospital administrators and doctors all the time refer to the insurance companies as the payer. I want every doctor to hear me when I say this. The payer is staring you in the face when you're writing that prescription. That's the payer of healthcare because their paycheck is impacted by whatever you write on that prescription pad. Their out of pocket is affected by whatever you write on that prescription pad. Their future wage increases are impacted by whatever you put on that prescription pad. I think that when doctors and hospitals call the carriers the payer, they're allowing themselves to disassociate themselves from the financial damage that the care is about to do. And I don't care how good your advice is, how good your prescription is for that problem. If they can't afford it, you might as well not have written that prescription at all. If we don't start to take cost into account, which we haven't been, particularly doctors, we're giving care that they're never going to be able to utilize.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of truth to that. And finally, when it comes to quality, I hear this word thrown around all the time, especially the last 10 years. I feel like you can't get away from it. Well, we want high quality, low cost care. We want to have a new process that provides higher quality to our patients. Quality, yep. Quality, quality. I mean, you hear that. It's not just in medicine. You hear that all sort of in the industry, all over in commerce. But I've talked to someone who helped. I guess he was sort of a broker. I'm trying to remember what he was. He was a healthcare consultant. Anyway, okay. He would say, generally speaking, in healthcare, if you were trying to find some high quality care, he said quality is, it's very difficult to sort of define. It's difficult to measure in many ways. You know, you ask who's a high quality physician, for instance. And he said, the one thing you can tell is you can tell who's a low quality physician. Like, you know, you can usually the bottom 25%, it's pretty obvious they're not any good. Bottom 25% of any sort of industry, hospital, surgeons, whatever, you can tell that. Aside from that, it's really kind of tough. It's, you know, the top 75% are somewhere in there. And, you know, maybe some people have good outcomes or bad outcomes. But how do you, as someone who's finding all this stuff for your clients, how do you know who is a high quality provider, high quality hospital, et cetera, and that you're not accidentally finding one that's maybe, you know, low quality and the high quality 75% or something?
Well, we use a lot of tools, but let me start off by explaining to you how and why cost and quality are inversely related in healthcare. We often think of higher cost equals higher quality, right? Cars, homes, right. Meals, we expect that. But in healthcare, they're inversely related. And the number one factor that determines that is frequency. The more frequently a doctor in a hospital do a particular procedure, surprise, surprise, the better they do it and the more efficiently they do it. Sure. So, you know, we avoid, and I have data to back this up, but we avoid at all costs the general hospital because they're a jack of all trades and a master of none. And if you're going into a general hospital for orthopedic surgery, for example, you're also exposing yourself to COVID and pneumonia and doctors and nurses that treat cancer and all sorts of other ailments. And nobody's good at anything. They're all, you know, mediocre at everything. And the cost is so high because they have to have those ventilators on standby and the ICU on standby, things that you may never need or use, but you still have to pay your share of because you went there versus go to an orthopedic specialty surgical center. That's all they do. And if you call up to verify your appointment for surgery on next Tuesday, and you're like, is it still on for Tuesday? They're like, whoa, did you just cough? You know, if you're not feeling well, don't just, we'll put it off. Just come back when you're better. So that's part of it. Now, if you actually look at cost and quality, which we have access to, you will see those same things occur. And the higher quality physician and facility is almost always at the lower end of the price spectrum. Now, how do we look at quality? Well, listen, I believe that doctors are so afraid of being measured on their quality. But if they don't, if every specialty doesn't come together and say, okay, as cardiologists, this is what we think a comprehensive list of quality metrics should look like. As orthopedics, this is what it's orthopods, this is what it should look like. Then someone's going to put that on them. And they're not going to like the way it's done. So I implore any doctor listening to this to stand up and say, we have to be judged on quality. We think of what you buy yourself, doctor. Do you expect to have quality information available to you when you buy a car? Like, of course you do. But I want quality information when I'm going to undergo surgery. So we use multiple tools that we can look at, the facility quality and the provider quality. In the provider quality side, we actually use a service called Quantros, and they look at billions and billions of claims data for decades. And I can actually see, I can look up a specific provider, and I can look up like a DRG of 470, for example, major hip or knee replacement without major complications, probably the most common DRG in an employer's data set. I could see not just how frequently they do it, but I can actually see age group, gender. And so, you know how I mentioned in our plans, we waive the out of pocket when we steer people to where we know the quality is high and the cost is reasonable. A lot of people say, well, don't you just have a list? Can you just give me a list? And I say, no, because one person needed a knee arthroscopy and he's a 28-year-old former college athlete in perfect shape. And the other employee needs a knee arthroscopy and she's 63 years old. She's morbidly obese and type 2 diabetic female. Like, that's going to be two different skill sets of surgeons, right? So, you know, or I'm not going to send them to an orthopod when they need a hand surgery, which is very delicate, very, you know, precise. And you want someone that does hand surgery every day, all day long. So that's why we get very specific. But the difference in cost, and I'll give you this one actual example, is a hysterectomy. Most women go to their OBGYN for a hysterectomy, but here's some stats. There's 550,000 hysterectomies done each year. There's 58,000 OBGYNs. That means each does 8 or 9 a year. And because they do so few, they're not very good at it, right? Think about a sports player, professional sports. You think they only practice 8 or 9 times a year? No, they practice 8 or 9 times a week, right? So that OBGYN relies on the techniques they learned in medical school to perform surgery, which is open surgery typically. So they're doing open hysterectomies, which is not good for the patient, higher infection rates. Here's another crazy part though. If they did go to learn laparoscopic, they'd have to take dozens and dozens of hours of training, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on additional equipment. And then the average insurance plan considers that to be a less invasive surgery. So they're going to get a lower reimbursement rate. Why would they do that? So we have a relationship with a network of gynecological surgeons who actually think that obstetrics and gynecology should be split into two different specialties. And each of these doctors do 300 to 400 hysterectomies a year. They have a 97% plus laparoscopic rate. And despite the national average of a hysterectomy being around 38,000, we have a prearranged, pre-negotiated bundled price of $11,000. Now, bundled is important, because bundled means if there's a mistake, a readmission, a redo, that's on the facility and the doctor, not the insurance company. So I say to employers all the time, would you rather your employee go to the $38,000 place where they're going to pay $5,000 and you're going to pay $33,000? Or would you instead consider allowing them to go to the $11,000 place, you pay $11,000, they pay nothing, they get back to work in 2 days on Advil only instead of 2 weeks on opioids? Like, it's better for everyone. And just so everyone knows, I don't just talk the talk. I mentioned earlier that I had surgery at the Surgery Center of Oklahoma for an inguinal hernia, and my wife had her hysterectomy done by the doctors that I was just speaking of. So we do it as well. We believe in it.
Yeah, well, that's there's so many things that occur in life that you think an incentive should be aligned, and you think that this is one of those situations where you'd have people, the employers obviously want lower costs, but they also want their employees back to work. They want them healthy. That's a provided benefit. That's obviously what the employee wants. And you'd think that there'd be plenty of places that provide that service. But because of our strange sort of incentivized system in healthcare, it's not worked out that way as it should.
Correct.
I really appreciate the conversation. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. Where's a good place for people to find out more about you and about, you know, what you're writing, social media, those sorts of things?
LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. There's a few books out there that either speak to what we do or speak exactly of what we do. And I'll give a couple of shout outs. One is a new book by Marshall Allen called Never Pay the First Bill. Very telling on hospital billing and how you can lower your own out of pocket, even if it truly is your deductible or something you owe. And then I think if you really want to learn some of the dysfunction actually from a provider side, The Price We Pay by Dr. Marty McCarry. That's also an amazing book. And we're also putting on an in-person conference in February in Phoenix, where we want doctors, employers, brokers, and advisors to all come together. We're going to show everyone what we're doing. We're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And how other people, we want to spread this. We want more employers to do this. If the small and mid-sized employers are going to be the ones that fix healthcare, if it gets fixed at all. It's not going to be the large employers. It's not going to be the government. It's going to be the small and mid-sized family-owned businesses that fix this. So we can show you how to have immediate impact on your employees, your bottom line, and get your employees healthier and back to work quicker than they're doing right now.
And where would people find that conference?
Also on LinkedIn, or you can go to ePower. So my firm's epoweredbenefits.com, E-P-O-W-E-R-E-D benefits.com. You'll find a link to that there, but we're also posting it up pretty regularly too, how to attend and the details.
Sure. Yeah. And along with you, I agree that legislatively this is not going to fix healthcare. We're not going to find some big bill that's going to come out of DC. It seems to be less and less things that are useful that come out of DC or state capitals. But I do think that with the tremendous cost savings right now, we're at a point where there's so much incentive to actually solve this problem that people are actually solving it. I think actually it's going to fix things. It's almost like the Uber, sort of the argument for Uber or Airbnb, right? Like once the taxi business just becomes too expensive and you find an alternative that is, you know, 1/10 or less of the cost, people have no choice but to adopt it. And I think that's where we're going. I'm much more optimistic about medicine than I was a few years ago because of people I've talked to like you, and just I think the incentives are just so tremendous right now in the savings.
Well, and there's just two last things I'd like to say. One is we do work very closely with providers, and in particular, we love a model of primary care called direct primary care. And yes. When we build direct primary care, a plan around that direct primary care provider, we remove all pre-certification, all prior authorization, all step therapy from that doctor. If that doctor says it's medically necessary, they do not need permission from anyone. It's covered automatically and covered in full by that patient's health plan, number one. But we've spoken about saving money, but how much are we talking about here? So I want to give you a metric. I'd like for everyone who's listening to this to either get this information, or if you know it in your head, calculate it. Super simple. Over a 12-month period, how much did you spend on your company's healthcare? So it's, if you're fully insured, just what was your premium? If you're self-insured, what was your claims plus all your fixed costs over a 12-month period? And then I want you to divide that by the average number of employees you had on your plan, not family members, just employees. And that's going to give you your per employee per year cost. The Kaiser Family Foundation says that that's around $16,000 per employee per year. Our plans run from between $3,300 and $7,700 per employee per year. I'm throwing my number out there for anyone that's listening. So if you're running higher than that, there's a lot of savings to be had.
Right. And I really appreciate the conversation. I think, you know, this is something that people need to look into, and Free Market Medical Alliance is a great resource too, I believe, where the people talking about the same thing that you're talking about today. So David Cotterno from ePower Benefits, thank you so much for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.